Amen. All right. Who is Jesus? That's the question we're now wading into. We've been dealing with what did Jesus do? What did Jesus say? And ultimately, at the end of last class, we talked about how the deeds and the words of Jesus point to his identity. So I want to start off today by asking the question, who is Jesus? What I want to do is I'm going to have you guys spontaneously answer that question at some point. But what I want to do over the next class period or two is to lay a general foundation of categories of identities of Jesus that we at least need to say, at least. And the way we're going to progress through this is by looking at the four Gospels, in particular their genealogies. I'm convinced that with the genealogies on some level that you can get a picture of Jesus that is trying to be painted in that particular gospel on some level. However, I want to say this at the very beginning. Every gospel is intending to communicate multiple layers of the identity of Jesus. Every gospel is intending to communicate more than one thing about who Jesus is. And yet, every gospel seems to have a primary driving emphasis. A primary driving emphasis. Do you understand what I mean by that caveat? That's a pretty important one. It's not that Matthew's going, I'm the only one that says Jesus is, you know, a Prince of Peace. No, the rest of them will say the same things that Matthew say. It's just that Matthew seems to emphasize one particular aspect with the other ones sprinkled throughout. Same thing with Mark and Luke and John. Okay? When we come to the genealogies, they're really important really for two reasons. In the ancient world, when you were a Jew, a genealogy was valuable for two levels. Number one, it actually was a legal document that described on some level what you had a claim to, what your inheritance could be. It was a document that traced back your lineage that says, whatever belongs to this line, I stand to receive that which is being passed down. It's a legal document that is tied to your inheritance. Inheritance not just, this is important, not just of money, but also of honor or shame. You inherit your honor and shame. In the ancient world, and frankly in the Middle East today, the dominant currency was not time and money like it is in the Western world. That is what drives our society. Our society is driven by how do we get the most amount of money in the least amount of time. And even morals can kind of be flubbed and even blurred on some level if you can accomplish those two things. It's kind of strange to me how we value that at such a high level. Most amount of money, least amount of time. So, you know, the Forbes list, they'll even have a Forbes top 25 millionaires under the age of 25. Why report that? Because in our society, the most amount of money in the least amount of time is something that deserves to be praised. And yet I'm going, but you have a problem with robbing a bank. Like, you'd think that that also be a viable way because that moves on our dominant currency. But even your dominant currency sometimes gets crossed, sometimes it gets flubbed, but sometimes morals just kind of get glossed over as well. Insider trading, at to date, not a single person from Wall Street has ever been convicted of a crime, even though we know they do things illegal all the time. Why? Most amount of money, least amount of time. That's what we value. And so we'll even gloss over things in order to honor this, because that's what we are. The ancient world and even the Middle East today is not that. They're driven by honor and shame. That is who they are. They are pursuing honor and protecting themselves from shame. All their decisions are made that way. The example I give consistently whenever I talk about honor and shame is something that happened to me, it's been about 12 years ago now. Summer after 9/11, I went over to the Middle East to evangelize to Muslims. And I'm in the Middle East, and today, to this very day, they're an honor-shame society, which may on some level should at least at some point be brought up in the conversations of the way in which we are engaging the Middle East militaristically, because we're shaming them in the ways in which we're doing it, and it perpetuates a spiral of needing to grasp back honor. But that's a whole other issue. I'm standing at this kiosk because I'm 19, I'm over in the Middle East, and it's been 4 or 5 days and I forgot to call home. So I needed to get an international phone card. So I go up to this little kiosk, and this thing was probably about the size of these 3-4 desks. Very small. The guy slides across the phone card. I'm going down, I'm flipping through my money. I set my money up there. I look up. He's gone. Totally gone. And I'm like looking around like, what's happening? I mean, it's this big. It's not like he can just, I thought he might have ducked down. So I kind of leaned over the top. I didn't see him. I didn't know what was going on. I look over. He's running down the street. Like in a kind of a little bit of a jog. And I was like, what is happening? And I see this group and they're all gathered together. And there's these two guys in the middle and you can kind of just see a commotion. And I look at the more experienced missionary behind me. I was like, what is happening? And he's like, oh, there's honor that needs to be given out. There's an argument between these two men. And the community is coming together to deliberate which one is honorable and which one is shameful. Which one, in some sense, needs to or has earned more honor, acquired more honor, and which one, in some sense, has lost it. And I sat there and thought, I think I even said it loud. I said, but the phone card of the money is still on the kiosk. I could take both of these and leave. And it made me stop and realize what I value, they don't value. For him, the time and money that I was losing in that moment was not as important, that he could have even lost in that moment, time and money, because I could have taken both and walked away. That was not as important as dealing with this honor-shame situation, because this is the dominant currency. This is what means most to their society. A genealogy, on some level, is tracing the inheritance monetarily, as well as honor-wise. And frankly, for them, the honor was more important, which is really strange whenever then you find like prostitutes inside of Jesus' genealogy. A very interesting caveat. Because you're supposed to gloss over those. Or bad kings. You're supposed to get rid of those. You're supposed to skip a generation. We even know. What's even crazy about Matthew chapter 1 with his genealogy in there? We know he skips over genealogy or over different generations, over different names. We know he does. Because there isn't just three perfect 14 names, generations, that you can split up Jesus' genealogy. Because we have other genealogies in the Old Testament. He intentionally is selecting these names out. And so it's really weird whenever he's choosing things like four different women. Or whenever he's choosing things like really bad evil kings. Because that's not what a genealogy is supposed to do. It is supposed to, on some level, trace the inheritance that you receive of honor, your ascribed honor, what is handed down to you. Genealogies also, though, were celebrated in the nation of Israel because it traced the movement of God. The probability of you being here right now, in this moment, in this setting with the people next to you, is frankly just psychotic. I'm not even talking about, you know, the ridiculous numbers that are thrown out there when it comes to, evolutionary theory and things of that nature. Let's set those aside. All the different things that had to happen in order for you to be in your seat right now next to the person that is sitting next to you. I mean, we're talking, for example, my story. If you look at my story almost wasn't this story. Because my mom and dad, they were pregnant before they were married. And they were actually dating other people when my mom found out she was pregnant. And my mom almost went to get an abortion of my older brother before her friend talked her into telling my dad. And when she told my dad said, "We're getting married." And they did, and they've been together for over 30 years. All the little things that had to happen for me to actually be standing here right now is frankly astronomical. The probabilities are ridiculous. And then combine that with every one of your stories that had to go the exact way for you to be sitting here right now, from your parents to your parents' parents to your parents' parents' parents, to maybe even you not even getting sick or your parents not getting sick whenever you were in the womb. So many things had to go so that you could be here right now that frankly you could even call this very moment an act of God. It's just ridiculous. The probabilities. And that's something else they celebrated in genealogies. That God's hand moves through flawed and chaotic humanity in order to bring about this moment, in order to progress His story. And genealogy celebrated that. So whenever they see genealogies, they don't skip over them. They look at them and they savor every name as a celebration of God and the honor they're receiving as being a part of that lineage. That's why genealogies abound in the ancient world. They're everywhere. The Old Testament, and again, it's probably the things that you skip over whenever you're reading through the Bible in a year. You get to the genealogies of the Old Testament, you're like, blah, 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 father of, son of, died at, okay. But for them, they're going, every name's attached to a story. And every story woven together becomes God's story beyond all probability. Even you. So, on some level, knowing that the New Testament begins with the genealogy, I would suggest we should begin there because it probably will tell us something about who Jesus is. And all four of the Gospels do the same thing with the genealogies or lack thereof. Matthew's Gospel we will begin with because on some level we've already been primed to know what Matthew's Gospel is going to be indicating. Because we've been tracing Matthew's Gospel with the words of Jesus. So it shouldn't surprise you whenever you see the very first verse of Matthew's Gospel. This is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah. Why in the world is NIV doing weird things? The Christ. Why in the world would I put an English transliteration of a Hebrew word to describe the transliteration of a Greek word that is translating the Hebrew word? Okay. The genealogy of Jesus, I'm just going to say Christ because I don't understand what they're doing with the Messiah. Of Jesus, the Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. In the first verse, you notice a couple of things. Number one, he calls Jesus the anointed one. He is the Christ. He is the King. Right off the bat, he is saying something about the identity of Jesus in the very first several words. This is the King. And he emphasizes that with the last half of verse 1. Because normally in a genealogy, the way that he would order it would be the son of Abraham, the son of David. But he switches the order. What is the significance of putting David before Abraham? Say it again. He's saying on some level that what David brings to the table is more important to the story of Jesus. It's not that Abraham is to be discounted. We'll talk about why Abraham's significant too. But on some sense, he is emphasizing David. David's connection to Jesus. What is David's significant contribution to the story of Christ? Who is David?
He was an anointed one.
He was a king. That is the sterile version of his story. If I'm a Jew and I hear the name David, what do I think?
A king that built the kingdom to the greatest point, helped build the temple.
Yeah. He is the archetypal king. There is no king like David. He is the height of honor when it comes to the kings. Every king, even though he wasn't the first king, he is the king. As a matter of fact, he is the only one of the kings that has promised to him that someone will rule on the throne forever and ever from the lineage of David. Even in the time leading up to the New Testament, one of the ways in which they even with the litmus test of whether or not they had a legitimate king was, are they from the line of David? That was one of the major problems with the Hasmonean dynasty in the intertestamental period with the Maccabean revolt. Is whenever John Hyrcanus says, I am king and priest, their problem was, number one, you're not from the lineage of Zadok, so you can't be the high priest. And number two, you're not from the lineage of David. So they didn't think the kingdom was restored yet. Because David is the archetypal king. And from his line, the kingdom of Israel will be restored. And whenever it's restored, it will reign forever and ever and ever and ever. This is Jesus, the King, the Son of David, the King, the Son of Abraham. He's not just some random king. He is the King that fulfills all the promises that trace all the way back to Genesis 12. He is the Jewish King. He is the king that the covenant that was made of Abraham, that even predates the covenant of Moses, will come to fruition through. It is that king. That king that ultimately, I think on some level, Matthew is saying, it is the king that has descendants as numerous as the stars, that brings all the nations honor and glory and blessing through him. He is the king. So right off the bat, even if I don't even get to the genealogy of Matthew, I could assume that Matthew's gospel is probably going to be talking about what in regards to Jesus? His kingship. We've already talked about how Matthew is saturated with kingdom language. Guess what? Every kingdom has a king. Every kingdom has a king. And that's what the genealogy is celebrating. Verses 2 through the first half of 6. Abraham was the father of Isaac. That's important. Isaac, the father of Jacob, who would become Israel. Jacob, the father of Judah and his brothers. Notice even what he does there. What does he do there? What does he do there? Jacob, the father of Judah and his brothers. What did he do? He really emphasizes Judah. Because remember, there's 12 sons. They're all pretty important. They all get a tribe. Why Judah is the only one that's named by name and pulled out? What's that? Yeah, because this king will be the lion from the tribe of Judah. So he's emphasizing Jesus' identity. Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. Hello! Perez, the father of Hezron. Hezron, the father of Ram. Ram, the father of Amminadab. Amminadab, the father of Nation. Nation, the father of Salmon. Salmon, the father of Boaz. Whose mother was Rahab? Remember the lady that lied and makes it into the Faith Hall of Fame? Yeah, that's part of Jesus' lineage. Boaz, the father of Obed. Whose mother was Ruth? You know, the woman who commits the, honestly, immoral indiscretion of sleeping at the feet of a man when they're not married? Yep, that's in Jesus' line too. Obed, the father of Jesse. Jesse, the father of, notice something that shifts in the next two words. What do you notice is different at the end of verse 6, the first half of verse 6? Jesse, the father of, what does it do that has not done yet this whole time? It adds a title to a name. And the title is King David. See, no one else gets that designation. And it's not like the patriarch and the honored and blessed Abraham, although all of those are legitimate. No, it just says Abraham, the father of Isaac. Isaac, the father of Jacob. And then it gets down to Jesse, the father of King David. Why? Well, because Matthew's trying to scream something into your ear. I'm talking about who Jesus is. He is the King. That's who He is. The King. So we have a kingdom established in the first four verses of the genealogy. A kingdom established. And then when we go through in verse, the last half of verse 6 all the way into the end of verse 11 is we have an alternation between good king, bad king, good king, bad king, good king, bad king. Consistently. David was the father of Solomon, whose mother had been Uriah's wife. Ooh, what story did he bring up there? He didn't have to bring that up. What did he bring up? Yeah, Bathsheba. Her name is in between the letters there. Whose mother had been Uriah's wife. He even brings up the sin. He brings it up. That is not the way you communicate an inheritance. Not of honor. You don't bring up the worst sins in the entire lineage. By the way, it was Uriah's wife. You know, the one that was duped, deceived, lied to, murdered, and then adultered. His wife was anyway. You know that guy? Yeah, that's in Jesus' lineage too. See, it doesn't just describe a title of Jesus. It describes a type of what Jesus is. He's not just a king. He is a king that is in this type of lineage. That's taking this type of honor and that is transforming this type of story. You see, you cannot just call Jesus a king. You have to know what type of king he is. And that is the constant thing that is grating and raging in the Gospel of Matthew. It is not sufficient enough to say that Jesus is king. It is essential to know what type of king he is. Because there's a difference. A lot of people have claimed the title of king, friends. A lot of people have. Even till today. I mean, whether or not you call it president or prime minister, a lot of people have claimed the title of king. But what type of king it is changes the story. It ends in verse 11, the second portion, in Josiah, the father of Jeconiah and his brothers, at the time of the exile to Babylon. And if you're tracing the story, this is a very depressing verse. Because this is where the kingdom is lost, where the kingdom is shattered, where the kingdom is thrown down. Where through the rebellion that we've just seen in the last four or five verses, ultimately comes to a point where God says, that's enough. Oh, I think one of the most heartbreaking verses, maybe in the entire Bible, but especially the Old Testament, is Daniel chapter 1. Daniel chapter 1, very first verse. It's just one of those where you can hear the weeping almost in the background as they're writing or as they're even reading out loud the verse where it says, "In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it." And then verse 2, "And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia and put in the treasure house of his God." I don't even know if I can fathom the depths of the pain of that. You have some psalms that cry out for that, where they're on the banks of Babylon crying out to God. Because the very items you used in your temple to worship Yahweh are now being used in the temple of Marduk to worship the king god of the Babylonians. Why? How has this shame occurred? This shameful act, not just on you, but on your God. How has this happened? Your rebellion. Your idolatry. This is the answer to the Israelites. "For blood is on your hands because you don't know me." You don't know me. Remember Isaiah 1? "And Josiah, the father of Jeconiah and his brothers at the time of the exile to Babylon." Then it starts in verse 12 with a bit of an up note. And it just builds. Although, frankly, we know less of the names that occur in the verses 12 through 16 than we do from verses 2 to 11. We know less. After the exile to Babylon, Jeconiah was the father of Shealtiel. Shealtiel, the father of Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel, the father of Abiud. Abiud, the father of Eliakim. Eliakim, the father of Azar. Some of those names we know. The restoration of the temple. The return of the exiles on some level under the Persian Empire. We know some of these names. Azar, the father of Zadok. Zadok, the father of Achim. Achim, the father of Elihud. More than likely, that's not the Zadok that is the priestly line, because Zadok would have been around the time of David. However, the fact that his name is Zadok probably points to his lineage as well. But that's not what this lineage is tracing. It's tracing it through David. Eliud, the father of Eleazar. Eleazar, the father of Mathan. Mathan, the father of Jacob. And Jacob, the father of Joseph. And the husband of Mary. And Mary was the mother of Jesus, who is called King. It begins and ends with the same designation. So if you just pick up Matthew's gospel, very first time reading through it, what would you think that Matthew's gospel is trying to communicate on some level? Who is Jesus? King! You cannot miss in Matthew's gospel. Jesus is King. Over and above every other claim, he is King. It's even the very first thing that's screamed out in chapter 2. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews?" What did they claim for him to be? What did they say that he was? King. You know what's interesting? Is in Matthew's gospel, first of all, that is the only time somebody on the side of Jesus actually gives him the title of Basileus, King. The only time in Matthew's gospel that someone on Jesus' side calls him King. The other time that term, not Christos, but the word for King is used in attaching to Jesus, it's used four other times. The next time is in chapter 27, verse 11. It's been a long time since he's been called King at this point in the Gospel of Matthew. Meanwhile, Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Next time Jesus is even remotely related to the word king, it's through the mouth of a foreign governor known as Pilate, who will be the one that tries to flaunt his power, even killing Jesus. The next time Jesus is called king is in verse 29. "And then they twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on his head. They put a staff in his right hand. Then they knelt in front of him and mocked him by saying, 'Hail, King of the Jews!'" The next time Jesus is called king is in verse 37. "Above his head they placed the written charge against him. 'This is Jesus, the King of the Jews.'" And then verse 42. "He saved others," they said, "but he can't save himself. Oh, he's the king of Israel. Let him come down from the cross, and then we will believe in him." What's interesting in Matthew's gospel is even though he's announcing Jesus as king, the words of the king come out of his mouth are never anybody on the inside. Matter of fact, where do the Magi come from? The Far East. They come from the Far East, and they're the closest ones to someone on the side of Jesus that even utters the name king throughout the book. The other times, it's Pilate. It's the mocking of the soldiers. It's the charge above his head. And ultimately, it is the people at the foot of the cross. Why does Matthew do this? Why on some level is Matthew putting the word king in the mouths of Jesus' enemies primarily? Any thoughts? Isn't that weird? You begin your gospel by saying, this is the king. So then why is it that the enemies are the ones that are pronouncing it? And even the way they're pronouncing it, we don't even really like. Help me. Brainstorm. Why is Matthew doing this? No thoughts, or you don't understand the question? That's not me being facetious, I mean. What's the purpose of this? It's a simple word study. What's the evidence? What do you conclude? As a matter of fact, another thing that's interesting, the very first time that the word king is used in chapter 2, it's in the context of persecution, isn't it? Where's the king of the Jews? And what's Herod do? What does King Herod do? Starts killing all the kids under the age of 2. How is he using the word king attached to Jesus?
That makes me think of John chapter 1 where it says he came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him.
Okay, absolutely. So what is the connection you're making here? I think it's a good one.
I don't know.
No, but you made it. It's good. On some level, there's an element of rejection that goes in this kingship. Right?
Yes.
Came to his own, and what? They didn't know him. Another way, if I would rephrase what you said, this is what I would say. People called him king, they just didn't know what type of king he was. Right? He came to his own, but they didn't know him. They didn't know him? Well, they knew he claimed to be a king. They just didn't know what type of king it was. They thought it was a king like Caesar. They thought it was son of David, son of Julius. They thought it was a king like the emperor. But the whole Gospel of Matthew is saying, if you understand the concept of kingship through me, you will understand that inextricably linked to the kingship of Jesus is the cross. You would get it. This is the fascinating thing whenever we get to Mark's gospel and the motif of kingship in there. Mark's gospel emphasizes something very similar. It begins with an offstage comment. This is Jesus. The beginning of Jesus, the good news of Jesus, the Son of God. It's king language. The only other people that call Jesus Son of God are either demons or the centurion at the very end. Outsiders, truly this man is the Son of God. And it's at the cross that the most clearest declaration of Jesus by someone in the story is even said. Truly this is the King. Why? Because you cannot understand the kingship of Jesus if you don't understand that it is inextricably linked to the cross. What type of King Jesus is almost more important than even just the fact that you identify him as King. Why would I say something like that? Why am I making such a big deal about this? Well, because ultimately, Jesus' identity will directly impact our identity. And if you don't know what type of king he is, it may change how you function and who you view yourself to be. You won't know what kingdom he established. You might, if you define Jesus in the same way that you define Caesar, that kingship, then you may not even actually see that we are a kingdom that's reigning right now. You just may miss it. Totally miss it. Why? Because what type of king he is almost more important than the fact that he is a king at all. Because what were they expecting? We've talked about this. What is John the Baptist expecting? Well, they're expecting a king. But they're expecting a king that has a bigger stick than Caesar. And the whole Gospel of Matthew is screaming out, he is king, but he will not be molded in your molds of kingship. He has come to define the kingship through his life, through his ministry, and most importantly, through his death. Do not force him into the box in the language of your kingship. He is king, but unlike any king you have ever seen. This is one of the things that's so important when we're talking about the identity of Jesus. The Catholics throughout the history of interpretation have had something that's very helpful that we have lost in our tradition and we need to regain. It's called analogous speech or analogy. And it's the way that they would even say, this is how, if we're going to speak about God, we have to speak about him like this. Because the moment that you say something affirming God, which is called cataphatic speech, you affirm God. You say, God is, let's say, Father, or Jesus is King. Those are true, but then they would immediately follow it up with what's called apophatic speech. Follow me, I'm going somewhere. They would say, but he is more like, unlike a king, as you understand it, than he is like it. He is more unlike a father, as you understand it, than he is like it. And when you bring those together, then it says this, God is Father. But he is not like a father in any way that you understand it. Matter of fact, he's more unlike what you understand than he is like it. I'm not playing with word games here. Why am I saying it like this? Why is this important? It's because we can say it like this. Jesus is king. But he is more unlike any concept that you have of king than he is like it. And the moment that you even utter the word Jesus is king, you have to understand that your picture of what that means is always going to fall short of what he truly wants it to be. You have got to at the same time say, and yet I don't understand. I understand less than what I understand about what it means for him to be king. I understand it less. And if you have that position, that posture, then the cross fits in quite nicely. Because our primary pictures and understanding of kings have nothing to do with a towel and a basin. Our primary understanding of a king has nothing to do with his death. Our primary understanding of king has everything to do with a sword and with dominance and with viciousness. That's our concept of ruler. That's our concept of king. Now, he is a king, but it is more unlike any concept that you have of king than it is like it. And if you knew that was the category, you could start to approach the type of king that he is. Richard Hayes brings this up in his book, Moral Vision of the New Testament, or something like that. I forget the title. Moral Vision something. Where he says, he thinks this is one of the driving forces behind the messianic secret throughout Mark's gospel. He doesn't want them to say, that he is the Messiah. Not because he's not, but because he's more unlike Messiah in the way in which they understand it than he is like it. And the moment they would say it, it would fall short of who he is. The moment they would say it, it would actually minimize the true reality. It's one of the things that's fascinating to me when we look at the Psalms and the way in which they describe the kings, and they describe them in such this high, exalted, almost godlike status. And yet we all know it actually is over-exaggerated, hyperbolic of all of the kings they were talking about in the Psalms. And yet what's crazy is when you get to Jesus, those hyperboles, they don't just find fulfillment in him, they fall short of him. They're just not enough. Because, oh my goodness, he is king, but he is unlike any other king, unlike any concept of king that has ever crossed your mind. Because he so far surpasses it. So it should not shock you whenever his kingship looks like failure, but he says it's actually victory. What type of king Jesus is more important than you even being able to say the words, he is king. Because if you change the type of king he is, he's no longer the king that can actually save you, resurrect you, and ascend you the way in which he accomplishes in his accomplishments, which we will begin to talk about next week. Love you guys. See you in the morning. See you Tuesday morning.